for plebs by plebs, dropping the Bitcoin only signal. Pleb Underground. Welcome everyone to the Pleb Underground.
Pleb Underground welcomes you to episode 20 this year. I hope you found yourself stacking plenty. Real plebs can't stop buying the dip. Fractal and Eric advise, please enjoy your holiday trip. Psychedelics, they can seat us. You know fiat won't defeat us. Maybe consider putting down the bottle. You know life isn't meant to be led at full throttle. Things done well are meant to take time. Cook from fresh. You can make the sublime. Make your dressings, say your blessings before you eat, perhaps thank the divine. Kick back, roll some fat joints, listen to Bitcoiners making succinct points. Normies say Bitcoin is for buying drugs, but it's the fiat world that has the bigger thugs. Like the WEF, they're not all about group hugs. Bitcoiners know to fix, not eat the bugs. Bitcoin bulls, there's a herd of us. Wall Street know, now they've heard of us. Authoritarians want to murder us. The choice is simple. Verify or further trust.
Walton, that was absolutely awesome. Thank you so much. And if, in case you didn't understand from Walton's extremely complex rhyme, that's right, we've got two awesome Bitcoiners for our Christmas trip. / Christmas special. That's right. We've got Eric Kason. I hope I pronounced your last name right. And Fractal Encrypt. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on Pleb Underground. This is absolutely amazing.
Thanks for having us.
Fuck yeah, man. I'm excited. Thanks for having me.
So I just want to point out that there's a 75% chair ratio going on here, okay? There's three of us that have chairs. Fractal is the only hardcore Bitcoiner here who does not have a chair.
Although there's no proof of the lack of chair, to be fair.
You know what?
No doubt. Yeah, there's no way to verify this, but straight up, yeah, like I haven't had a chair in a long time. I had this chiropractor. He was like a 70-year-old man, and he was actually paralyzed. And he was like, he would tell me that sitting is the new smoking, and he's like, it's like really bad for you.
Sitting's awful.
Like, yeah, man. So no, I have a standing desk at my in my like art lab. I don't have no chair here at all. There's not even a fucking chair in the whole room.
You know what? Based on your previous work. Based on your previous work, I'm gonna have to trust that you're not on a chair.
No doubt. Actually, I'm sitting here. We go.
All right. Well, guys, you know what's about to happen. We are gonna dive into the numbers. Here we go.
The numbers, of course, brought to us by timechainstats.com. That's timechainstats.com, and a new way to browse the time chain. You can head over to timechaincalendar.com. That's timechaincalendar.com.
At the time of this recording, the block height is 768,669. The Bitcoin price, 16,836. Total public lightning capacity, 5,110.26. Moscow time, 5940. And the chain rewrite days, 871. I know, nobody cares, but you know what? I'm used to reading them off. So, yeah. They're uneventful and we don't really care. But we
read 69 in that.
It's all about the numbers, man. It's all about the numbers.
Yeah. You know what? It is sometimes, right? When I hit a 420 or a 69 in there, I kind of chuckle, you know, but yeah. Otherwise I don't really care.
No doubt. No, oh, but God. To me, I'm a Bitcoin data fanatic, man. I want to see all the numbers and get blockchain statistics and what's going on. I just love the numbers. So keep doing it. It's beautiful.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you. Well, on that note, let's just we're gonna dive in already. Here we go. So, tweet from HODLNOT. Just got informed that the Norwegian Court of Appeals have allowed Craig's appeal. He's gonna have to do it all over again, and he will. That absolutely just totally blows. Thanks to Walton for sharing this. Tweet from Alex Gladstein. Bloomberg out here estimated that 300 million people in India use Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. 64 million in Nigeria, 54 million in Pakistan. As far as I can tell. Okay, as far as I can tell, these numbers seem too high, but it'll be the reality either way in a few short years maximum. get ready for 1 billion users. All right, guys. So this is, even though this is numbers, this is also partial hopium. Let's, you know, let's be honest, that's some good hopium right there.
I'll just briefly say that I'm not a fan of Gladstein, though I did share this with you. and I don't follow him, even though apparently you do. Nonetheless, I'm not so sure about HRF. I think they're kind of WEF puppets a little bit. But he is sharing maybe some accurate numbers and certainly some positive looking numbers.
How far away do you think we are from 1 billion users? I am going to ask Eric this first, and then we'll go to Fractal Encrypt on that. How far away realistically do you think we are from 1 billion users? And not like it makes a difference because we're not experts at this, but you know, what are your thoughts?
In all honesty, like I'll be surprised if we ever actually get to 1 billion users. Like I'm a big fan. Like I don't think Bitcoin's designed for most people. I think it's too complicated. It's too hard. There's so much work that goes into being involved in this. And you know, like I'm a little heartbroken because so often I'll find that there's people that are like, what, like, what's so wrong with the world? And I'm like, oh, like, I got the answer. Let me tell you. And they're just like, what, like, this is too hard. Like, I can't understand that, you know, and like, that's what it is, you know? And I've said this before, but like, I'm really uninterested in the majority of people. Like, I'm really interested in the small intolerant minority who, when they come to me, instead of them being like, tell me about Bitcoin, they're much more like, I want to know about Bitcoin. Like, tell me how to use it better. Like, what else can I do? What are other things on your radar? Because those are the people who are really building and who are going to help create the better world that we want to see. And so I'm really only interested in that revolutionary vanguard that wants to make that change, and everybody else will follow. So for me, getting to 1 billion users isn't nearly as big of a deal as getting, you know, 100 million militant Bitcoiners who are utilizing this technology as a praxis, as opposed to, you know, being some fun internet money or something.
Yeah, well said. I like to say that Bitcoin isn't for everybody, but it is for anybody.
Yes.
It's very much a voluntary thing that you really have to pursue. And this is why I don't really like the idea that you orange pill people, because you don't orange pill someone when you get them to buy Bitcoin. You, like, they are orange pilled when they take on that personal responsibility and curiosity to start championing their own learning about Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm. They orange pill themselves. Yeah. They really That's do orange pill themselves.
That's what I believe, essentially. Yeah.
All right. So yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to add that, like, it's very pedagogical, you know, like you need to have that understanding of why Bitcoin creates self-sovereignty and empowerment in order to, like, continue the feedback and understanding that, like, this isn't like, oh, I'm learning about finance to get rich. This is like, oh, I'm learning about the tools of digital self-sovereignty so that, like, I can actually protect myself in a meaningful way.
I think that's incredibly important. And obviously, you know, I think one of the biggest hurdles that we have as not necessarily as Bitcoiners, but as I'd say as people learning about Bitcoin to overcome, right? Because you're essentially having to unlearn a lot of the bullshit that you've learned in order to be able to now fill this new void of space with new information that is correcting the old information. So Fractal.
That's quite often true with a lot of learning, though, Phil, to be fair. Like, in all education, you have to kind of deal with misconceptions that, you know, en route to kind of learning the truth.
Absolutely.
I do think psychedelics are a good way to get into that unlearning mindset for a lot of people, where it's like, you know, hey, there's been a curtain pulled over my reality here, and it kind of lets you pull back the veil in that sense. But, you know,
I want to circle back to this topic a little bit later in the show, because I think it's one it's one of the reasons I got this grouping together, because
certain phrases or words that might trigger me and it brings it out, but yeah, for sure.
No, it's
but
all good, man. We appreciate it.
Question, because you asked, like, okay, you know, how long till we get to 1 billion users or something like that, and I had just told you that numbers are beautiful, and then now we run into this situation where I'm like, wait, on-chain numbers are beautiful because there's a source of truth there, yet when we go into this off-chain data, then there's no way to really verify this. So this billion users, it's like, I actually have no clue how close we are, how far we are from that number. And I don't know that there's a real way to verify that type of thing. We can verify the node counts and things like that, and how many like public non-Tor nodes there are, things of that nature. So those numbers you can trust and say, like, these are actual users that, yeah, I mean, at least they have a node working. You don't know if each node represents one person or 10, or you know, if they're like even like a SPV wallet provider or something, it could represent thousands. But, you know, it's like, you know, at least there's that one there per whatever it is. So we run into these things where it's like, you hear these numbers. And when I saw that tweet too the other day, I was like, damn, like, that's more than I would have thought. Like, those numbers seem high to me.
Yep.
Because one time I ran into some argument where it was talking about how few number of people you need to really turn the tide. And it gave the example of kosher food, where it was saying that, I guess the population of Jewish people is so small in terms of world population, it's like a 1 or 2% of the people, yet you go into every grocery store and they pretty much have kosher food of some kind. And why is this? They say that because that 1 or 2% of people of the worldwide population is enough to move the needle, where there's buying power and there's financial power behind that. And it's recognized enough by the big players that they will take stock and note. And now that's become an everyday part of people's lives. So I definitely liked Eric's answer. And I think that that makes a lot more sense to me in a you know, the world that we live in. Although I think at some point you're going to crest over a stream where, you know, if we do hit hyper Bitcoinization, or there is some kind of currency that's based on Bitcoin, or if Bitcoin is the only reserve currency, then you'll have those billion users by default, because everybody will be using it. And not because it's hard or easy or confusing or not, it's just honestly, like, what is more confusing than the dollar and how they create it and make it, and how it's, you know, like the whole slavery behind that? There's nothing more confusing than the US dollar, and that's like the world reserve currency right now. But yet we all use it, because when you're born, someone, you know, your grandpa gives you a dollar when you see him, and it's like, oh, hey, cool, whatever. So like, you're taught that this has value. And I think like there will be just a shift in the world. And it's one of those slow incremental things. It may not be like this one moment that comes upon us where it's like, oh, okay, now, you know, we haven't this happen and it's going to be everybody's in on Bitcoin. No, it's more of just like a slow thing, and people use it not because they want to, but just because that's what people get paid in, or that's what people accept for their goods. And, you know, I think that's really why people work for the dollar, is because there's dollar denominated debt and dollar denominated economy that happens. So, okay, if I want food, I go to the grocery. Maybe if I go to the farmer's market, there's some people that take Bitcoin. So you learn how to work with these things. But, you know, I think the herd is going to follow the herd. So those type of things take time. And I really don't even know what a billion number people is in terms of the world population. I haven't like looked that up recently, but that seems like a lot.
Yeah, it's like an eighth or something like that. But yeah, exactly. I think,
well, holy shit. No, I don't think we're there.
Yeah. Right. Like, come on. There's like 7 points. What is it? 7.35 billion.
How do you find these things? There's probably statistical sampling. You know, there's a number of problems with where that number comes from. I can't imagine it's everyone being surveyed. It might be how many people have an account with something. You know, even if they have $10, like, does it, you know, and they keep it on exchange, does that really make them a user? No, it doesn't. In any way, shape.
That's another thing. Who is a user?
I'm sure there's a bunch of issues there. What? But if for a moment we can just have a little look at some dollar denominated spending.
Well, look at what we have done lately. This is just totally insane, and we haven't even started the next recession. When the next recession comes home to roost, this is going to be something horrific, because the revenues that the government is taking in are going to fall. And we just passed the Inflation Creation Act, I'm sorry, Inflation Reduction Act, which adds another $0.75 trillion to this. And so I just can't believe that the people running things are allowed to continue running things.
So guys, tell me more about the Inflation Creation Act. Sorry, Inflation Reduction Act. Is that really what it's called?
Have they actually called it that, guys? Just to keep that quiet. It's not inflation creation. It's inflation reduction. It's amazing to me how the naming of these bills has come to literally, it always represents its opposite. There's like a really interesting linguistic thing at play, like when you reach the end, because like one of my strongest beliefs is that like, because we live in fiat world where like lies have fundamentally become forms of truth, it caused for a hypostaticization of everything. So that like, literally when the liars are speaking towards things, they actually represent its polar opposite because they're embedded so deep in that. And it's just really strange how frequent and often that happens. And to me, like, this is just part of the generalized latent authoritarianism that pretty much has permeated everything, is that like no longer is the natural form of truth as a proof of work present itself as being true, but it's about the authoritarian decree of what is right, despite what might actually prove itself to be true.
It's a different form. Go ahead. Okay, I was just going to say, it's a different form of POW. It's proof of words. It's not the same thing, right? Like, that's all it is. Like, these are words. And it's crazy because they put this together, right? This information is put together and packaged in a way where we're supposed to be cheering this psychotic, shitty behavior that is worse for everyone involved. Like, this is the weird thing, right? These people, right? These people that are helping to push through these bills and to print all of this money, this ruins their lives too, incrementally. And it's strange because it just ruins their life a lot less. And they're okay with it.
But it's all about incentives. About incentives. And at the end of the day, the reason why these people lie is because they're not incentivized to tell the truth. And the reason why that is because it's because of central banking. When you have central banks buying sovereign debt because the governments are spending more than they collect in taxes, that enables the politicians to say all kinds of lies because they don't actually have to hold anything to account. Therefore, they aren't held to account. Like, they're incentivized to win popularity contests by lying. So ignore all these just idiots who are politicians that are going, oh yeah, I like Bitcoin. Ignore Dennis Porter and all that nonsense. Like I used to like Dennis, but come on, you're an idiot. Like, the politicians will say anything to gain votes. It's that simple. They are self-serving liars.
Well, and I think it's really important to point out that I very sincerely don't think that there's anybody kind of hanging around being like, haha, look, I'm going to lie about this to like get, like, I don't think they're maniacal. I think they're literally, they come from a nihilistic
opportunist. They're opportunists, right?
Yeah. And to them, they're like, look, like we have to obscure and obfuscate a little bit if we're going to try to get what we want. And I sincerely think most of them believe that printing out money and giving it to other people, like, is a great thing that's productive for everybody and helps. But like, this is one of the problems about that form of authoritarian thought where you've been told something is true and you move forward with that, is that most of us have been educated in Austrian economics, where we've discovered that modern monetary theory or Keynesianism is a pretty horrific thing that allows for the government now to manipulate, contort, and obscure the economy in such a way that, like, we're at like the 80-year or at the 100-year back end of this process, where like the entirety of our economy is part of a generalized war machine and all the tertiary apparatuses of that. And so, like, there was a question that I saw on Twitter earlier about like the difference between fiat and capitalism. And it's really hard to disentangle them because we're so deep into fiatism. It's literally impossible to see what a truly capitalist society would look like. And furthermore, that, like, in my opinion, anarcho-capitalism only makes sense through a lens of digitized, commoditized money, such as Bitcoin, because like now we're actually talking about a free market economy where like violence isn't an implicit part of how it functions.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Okay, let's go to Fractal. Let's see if he has any thoughts on this.
Eric brought up, the wordsmithery that goes on behind the naming of these bills. So you have something called the Inflation Reduction Act, where it's the exact opposite of that. And then, you know, then they look at you like, oh, you don't want to vote for the Save for the Children bill? You don't want to, like, save the children? So you know, that will just name the bills in these ways where it actually has nothing to do with the underlying text of the bill. You read the Save the Children bill and it actually got, you know, attacks against encryption or end-to-end encryption or any kind of self-sovereignty at all. And, you know, they hide all this in the, you know, page 984 of the bill. And, you know, then they just call it the Save the Children bill. And then if anybody doesn't want to vote for that, then they'll shame them on social media or whatever. And like, this person doesn't want to save children, so we need to cancel them immediately. So, you know, this wordsmithing is, again, I totally agree with Eric that there's nobody probably like, you know, doing that hand gesture and saying, like, twiddling their mustache, like, in an evil way. It's actually probably more just economic incentives. Like, maybe they have, like, lobbyists or people that are paying them to think or vote in a certain way, and that just influences their goals, because it's just purely like, hey, maybe, like, there's financial incentives in this for me to do this. Or it could be, you know, power incentives, because many politicians tend to be motivated by that. So it could be like a personal power motivation, or it could be like a financial motivation. It's nothing sinister or conspiracy at all. It's just simple, like, human nature. So I think a lot of these things are just, you know, like, oh, we got a bill that we're passing with $47 million, like, how much of that can we get for ourselves or our, you know, our team? And, you know, there's just a lot of that going on. You know, and I do also agree fully with Eric that you know, if you don't know anything about money and they purposely make it so that we don't, then yes, it actually seems like an awesome thing to print more of it and give it to people. I actually didn't think about that, like, how it seems like, yeah, like, that's actually like a good thing to do. To us, it seems fucking ridiculous. And like, why would you do that? But right, if you don't have that education or that baseline knowledge of, you know, how this money is actually debt slavery, then
I don't you have would a baseline knowledge, because they're gaslit by their government, right? Their government tells them that inflation is good.
Well, it's not even that. It's that you know, our entire education system is structured in a way where it's purposefully educating you about certain things, but then purposefully, you know, like, I'm losing the word before, but they're obfuscating things from
you, where exactly, it's
making it not obvious on purpose, because they don't want you to understand how these things work, because they're actually tools of your enslavement. So if you start figuring that stuff out too much, you know, you better do that on your own, because it's not coming through the public school system. I have nothing wrong with the public school system. I think that it's fine. It's just you have to recognize it for what it is. It's like it's basically creating more cogs that fit in the machine. Like, that's the entire goal of the education system, is just to create a good employee, you know? So you just have to recognize what they are.
The history we're taught is really interesting, because it's always this sort of narrative of like, well, the government's trying to be the good guy, and like, it makes mistakes sometimes, but always like, it always corrects that mistake, and like, it means well. And I just find it really
frustrating.
Oh yeah, like,
slavery was no big deal in elementary school. And it's like, oh, just this little temporary thing they did 100 years ago. So yeah.
Yeah, and then like, each successive step.
You gloss over that, you know?
Well, like with World War II, it's like with World War II, it's like the Allies were the good guys who were like saving the people from genocides. But then it's like, well, what was this Dresden bombing all about? Like, what about the firebombings of Tokyo? Like, what about all, you know, what about Operation Paperclip, where we integrated all of the Nazis directly into the American military apparatus, like, you know, the Tucci syphilis experiment. And like, I go through these dozens of things, and I always find it really interesting that people are like, yeah, like, mistakes were made, but like, now it's all good guys that are in the three-lettered agencies. And it's yes. Look, like, I mean, I get it's really hard and difficult, and I really want to empathize with, like, realizing that your government is a hateful apparatus that only has violence as its capacity to do things is really, really scary. But like, if we look at the chain of historicism, I really struggle to understand how we get to today, and that people are like,
what?
Uh-oh.
Weird. Okay.
Me? No worries, but it just strikes me as really absurd that most people can look at this chain of history and then be like, oh, but like, now things are actually good. And, you know, people aren't trying to oppress or hurt us, and that like, they're printing out money for the good of everybody. And I don't know. I mean, I'm really at the place that like, I really struggle to talk to normal people about stuff, just because I just feel really hurt and upset about it, because like, to me, they're so far behind on the general dialogue that like, they can't even get to the place of being like, oh, like, I'm getting totally hosed here, and like, I'm being completely taken advantage of on every way till Sunday.
They still believe that their government and, you know, their secret services are the good guys. Like they essentially,
like Carl Sagan says, their government,
their government is their god for many, many people essentially in the Western world, and whether they recognize
that's part of that education system, they're training you, you know, like be a patriot, you know, it's part of this whole thing, like that. Where are you getting your history from? It's from this well of this free public education system. So, yeah, I think fully that they're doing this in a purposeful way. And also, I really love to think about what Eric was talking about, like the history that we get, you don't think about it too much, but it's actually like there's so many holes in history. We actually only have a very small fraction of human history that we understand, because it's really history is written by the winners, and it's a series of winners. So everybody that's winning, you're kind of getting their version of the story, and you're just kind of sweeping away the losers. And every winner is always the good guy, like Eric was saying. You're like, hey, these are the good guys. You know, like, yeah, mistakes were made. Like, I just died over here. That was so funny. Like, yeah, mistakes are made. You know, we just, you know, we're all good, but sometimes we just make mistakes. Like, no, you know, like all history is a matter of, you know, you're getting the story from somebody who's basically feeding it to you, and they're at the top of it, and basically they're the good guys. So all history is suspect, which brings us back to Bitcoin, which has the one true history that we can all agree on. So I just love that we now have a countermeasure that is widely distributed, and that individuals can utilize and leverage for, you know, their own self-sovereign needs and tools and stuff. So I think like that we've always had this history fed down in a I don't know if it's top down way, in essence, like you're getting fed history from a higher source, but now it's like, no, the history is widely distributed, and if you try to feed me some bullshit, it's my node is going to reject that as invalid. And we haven't had this before.
This is an awesome history. Actually is like it is fundamentally a proof of stake, where they're like, hey, like here's our story, like take that on. And when you start to actually do the proof of work in history, you find all of those holes, and you realize that like the blockchain of history doesn't actually like sync up in any meaningful way. And that's why it's so important that we now have this time chain, because like it turns out that like the control of wealth is the most important thing that has ever happened. In addition to the fact of that, there's been a constant century-long propaganda war against people to understand the importance of that history, not only in terms of the actual historicism of events that have happened, but also the historicism of the actual accounting of how the general monetary system works. You know, because like if you actually understand how the Bretton Woods system came about, it's truly horrifying to realize that like we essentially played this shell game where we're like, yeah, like we're gonna get everybody back to a gold standard. But in the meantime, you guys should all take these dollars that will totally exchange for gold whenever you guys want. We absolutely will not inflate the shit out of it. Oh, and like this like former Nazi bank that we said that we would suspend, let's like make that into the Bank of International Settlements. Cause you know, like gold from the teeth of millions of dead Jews, like that's like a great base to like start an international monetary system. To me, like that's one of the ones that's like so horrifying, is realizing that like the Bank of International Settlements was literally the SS's gold laundering bank in Switzerland, and they decided to make that into the world's largest financial institution. Like what the hell.
This is by far the craziest numbers discussion we have ever had, and it's totally amazing. But we definitely are we have to move on to our next segment that we're diving into. That's right. We are diving into Wrecked.
Up next, we have Wrecked, sponsored by CryptoCloaks. CryptoCloaks.com or CryptoCloaks.eu. You can find a whole range of Bitcoin goodies, including the Honey Badger. You see Phil modeling there with the secret compartment in which you can keep your FUD dice or perhaps a signing device. Up next, you see the Hodler Nort helmet. Very nice. If you want to support the fight against the evil, buy that item. 50% of the donations will go to defendingbtc.com. And if you use the code Pleb Underground, you can get 5% off all of the Bitcoin goodies over at CryptoCloaks.com or CryptoCloaks.eu.
All right. On this special edition of Pleb Underground, I figured, you know, wrecked, we'd kind of go a little bit lighter, but still, you know, still make sure that the shitcoiners know that that they suck. So we have like a nice little mix, a nice little mix of wrecked. So the first one is a tweet from Joe Consorti. Joe was a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago. And this video is absolutely ridiculous. Here we go. The Guru Price Action Trading Course merchants are still solvent. So Jerome Powell has plenty of work to do. Send it all to zero. Okay, what is he talking about? Let's watch this.
Entering here. I want to see what happens around this area to see if we're going to drop or we're going to push up. Once I see this candle have no bearish momentum, I know that our support is strong enough to hold the support and we're going to push up. And look what happened right after that candle closed.
Yeah.
It pushed straight up. You know what I'm saying? So That's why I was like, okay, bet. You want to see what's going on at the levels of support. We got to push up. We got to high. We got to low. And this is called a, what kind of pullback is this? Complex fucking pullback. That's all it is, bro. Entering here.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm so sorry, but this right here, bro, this dude is cooked as fuck. Has no idea what's going on. I'm sorry, but yeah. Okay, so look, that hindsight trading shit. I'm sorry, but if you're paying those people for trading advice, you deserve to get wrecked. I mean that is the most ridiculous crap. And unfortunately, that tells us, right, that. Even though we seem to be in a bear market, apparently there's just a little bit more wrecked to go around.
Bill, they say hindsight is 2020, and it's clearly 2022, almost 2023. So guys, you're like 2 or 3 years behind. You got to catch up.
Oh, very well said. Okay. All right. So yeah, that was just a good little laugh at some just terrible, terrible advice. Anyways, all right, let's move on. It's the end of the year, right, guys? The end of the year. And you know what? Kind of like an I told you so. We like to do that. Here we go. This is a article out of the block. Here we go. The metaverse market collapses with monthly platform sales falling 96%. Oh my gosh. We are surprised. Monthly sales on the metaverse platforms fallen 96% this year. The Sandbox reclaimed its market dominance among metaverse Sandbox. Though Decentraland finished the year with the most valued metaverse land parcels. That does sound good. That does sound pretty good. While metaverse platforms brought in $49.2 million in monthly trading volume in January, that figure dropped to a mere $2 million in November. Okay, that's a 96% drop. And I mean, if you just take a look at some of these charts, I mean, this says it all, right? This is just absolute crap. And we're gonna.
I'd love to know like how the people are doing that we covered in the former shows. There was one guy that spent $300,000 on a house in the metaverse, but it was like detached in Miami. It had, you know, like a pool or something, 4 bedrooms, you know. Very nice house, but in the metaverse, so, you know, completely fucking worthless. Nonetheless, and then there was another guy who sold a kidney to buy an NFT. It doesn't cost an arm or a leg. They cost kidneys. They cost lives. Like, fuck shit coins. Stop it, please.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so here we're gonna continue on here. NFT World's lead metaverse.
Oh, and it says NFT marketplace OpenSea delisting Cuban artists and users right there. So that's certainly an interesting move. Sorry, right? I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just shocked to see them just single out the Cubans. It's like, yo, you guys aren't good enough for NFTs. Sorry, you know, your kidneys not gonna work over here.
You know, Fractal, they're building an open digital marketplace. So we shouldn't pay attention to the fact that they just censored Cuban artists.
we'll do surgery on your ass. Yeah.
it's just words. All right, we're going to wrap up
the things.
Huh? Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. I'll let you finish the segment.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up and then we can chat about this. NFT World's led metaverse land values over the first few months of 2022 with the average sale price of a virtual plot hitting a high of $44,000 in the week of February 26th. Decentraland now claims that lead, although at a much lower price, with an average of $1,780 per land parcel. Okay? So, and this is just a chart showing you essentially their you know, the average land sales price, and obviously you see it all trending to zero. So guys, somebody paid $44,000 for virtual land. You heard what Walton said before. I mean, look, Fractal, you're an artist. Why is the metaverse not like, why do you choose to create physical art? You know, how can you choose to create physical art, and why is it Bitcoin only?
Well, the thing is like, my art that I create is physical, but it all starts in a digital format for the most part now. Like, I used to be a traditional pencil artist, but, you know, like, no, I mean, anything that I do through the laser, CNC, you know, a lot of that's all just starts in the computer world. But the thing is like, it's just super easy to copy any kind of digital work. So if somebody does take the time to go ahead and like rebuild one of my sculptures or something, like, it took them some proof of work to actually like fake my stuff. It's a lot harder than right clicking and taking, you know. NFTs are a very touchy subject in the sense that they're just, you know, the people that are into it just seem to be very into it, and the people that are not into it, it's like very polarized in the sense that there's really not much middle ground. I actually was like super into it in 2017 when I got into Bitcoin at first, like as an artist, I came in and people were saying like, this is the, you know, this is the future of art. And I totally bought that hook, line and sinker, and your art will be on chain forever. And you know, that all this stuff appealed to me as an artist. It was like, hey, you know, you take control of your stuff. There's no gallery, no middleman. And like, there's just so much cool things about it that just seemed like, wow, this is really neat. But then, as I started looking into it, it was like, hey, wait, like, this thing works on a smart contract. What is this smart contract? And I start looking at it, and it's like, hey, wait, this is like written by some dude in like his underwear and a beard in New York City in an apartment drinking beer. And he has this pause feature on this contract that can reassign the token, like myself, sovereign art, and like take it away from me and give it to somebody else. And my art's not even on chain at all. So like, it was one of those things where I kind of like felt like I thought this was really cool, and I got duped by it. And the funny thing is Decentraland too. It's like, Decentraland, like, that I was all into shitcoining in 2017, so I thought all these shitcoins were cool. And Decentraland, I remember them talking about, hey, we're gonna release this cool like metaverse world, is gonna be awesome, and like, you're gonna come out. And like, I, like, as an artist, I'm like, okay, this is interesting, like, let's see what they're gonna do. And then they released it, and it looked like fucking South Park, dude. Like, their level of art was like basically a bunch of like little like Lego blocks that are walking around and shit. And I was like, this is the future. I was like, even as a dumb shit coiner, I was smart enough to see that stuff was dumb. And the virtual land thing, dude, oh my god, like, I remember watching people like early on like slinging these things, and like, you know, this stuff is like, was there was trading for a lot of money, as you saw, like, oh, this guy's paying $44,000 for like a fake house that doesn't even, like, there, you know, there's no way to actually assign like this digital ownership stuff, you know, in the, especially in the way that it's done on Decentraland or any of this stuff, like, that's like a complete theater. Yeah, so I, to me, see that, you know, I think you got me going on this one. Sorry.
I mean, this is the thing that I find so interesting about.
Sorry, Eric, go ahead.
This is what I find so interesting about like crypto and NFTs and virtual land, is that like, these are all these acronyms. So like, an NFT is supposed to stand for a non-fungible token. Well, it turns out that like all of the NFTs actually like are fungible insofar that like they're not actually on-chain forever. They don't have cryptography baked into them. They aren't actually decentralized. And then the same problem with crypto is like, crypto actually has broken its own relationship to cryptography, because like, it's centralized shitcoiny stuff that's actually not protected by robust cryptography or decentralization. And it's so interesting to me that this sort of nihilistic world viewpoint again has appropriated language in a way to render it useless. And it renders it useless for the specific objective to be able to grift around it, you know? And like, I think
absolutely. And that's grift like all the way top to bottom. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. And like, that's what's really sad, is that grift works so well because the nascent rhymezone at the very bottom, you know, like the promise that non-fungible tokens could be, has potentiality. And that grift is then used against artists in such a way to make sure that like, it burns that, you know. And so I recently tweeted, like, I'm excited to see how, you know, like the Ordinals project that essentially allows for you to have NFTs on Bitcoin. Like, I'm interested to see where that goes, because I want to see these sort of blended mediums where like the only way you get to view a digital piece of art is like destroying a physical piece of art or vice versa. And I think that there's real value there, but it has to be thoughtfully pursued. And it's very clear to me that everything up till now has frankly been a grift, you know? And
essentially is the illusion of scarcity of all of these things. They're selling, you know, limited edition, one of one, all this kind of thing. And the reason why the normies flock to it is because with fiat money printing, there isn't scarcity of money. And so they're desperately looking for places to put their money where they think that they can store it. They, you know, they don't really understand what they're doing. They're trying to do something good in theory. You know, they might buy complete crap. They might be buying, but other people are buying jewelry, or they're buying, I don't know, cars, or like there's a whole bunch of different things people put their money into that are very bad stores of value. But ultimately that's what they're trying to do. And they're being, you know, captivated by you know, magicians wearing a bunch of designer goods, you know, trying to sell them a story of riches.
Well, so like, I do think that was like a very interesting an interesting part of it, but I think that's only one layer of it. And I think like the deception works on many levels, and it even is a self-deception in many ways, because kind of how Eric mentioned that it's like ICOs, it's actually super like ICOs, because as an artist, think about it, you're actually releasing digital tokens that you want to sell to people that they're supposed to increase in value and or whatever it is. And honestly, the whole market of NFTs when I was doing it seemed to be make quick, fast work that other people can, you know, kind of sell and trade around. And like, it wasn't that people wanted to hold your stuff. Whereas now, like when people buy my art, like a lot of them want to hold it and keep it. And that kind of feels cool to me. Like, I don't really want people to like try to flip all my stuff and just make, you know, use it as a financial instrument. I think that's fine. I think like if you want a financial instrument, Bitcoin is far superior than my art, and you just buy Bitcoin to store your value. And if you like my art because it's beautiful to you, then you buy that. But I think that from the artist level, okay, you're issuing in essence shit coins. You know, you're wanting people, you're trying to take people's Bitcoin with your shit coin. So there's that level of it. But what's even more weird is that you're kind of like hired as an artist, because you're creating advertising for a shitcoin, because like you're creating utility for their base layer. So, okay, you know, by using our coin like to do your art, it's like also you become beholden to that. So in essence, these people that are at the top of the free money faucet have plenty of this free, easy money, and they use it to pay these artists who become advertisers for them, and they don't realize it, but they're becoming enslaved to this, you know, pre-mine culture. And they also become beholden to it in the way that it's now feeding their family, and they feel incentivized to keep doing this stuff. And like it takes over their vision and their goals, and they begin working for this, you know, entity that has now trapped them and enslaved them through these weird false promises. So there's this weird deception that happens on every level. And I definitely think Walton was right in hitting an interesting point that, yeah, people want to put their value in something, but there's just so many deep levels to the NFT thing. And I did see the ordinals thing, and I thought that was cool. One of the interesting things that ordinals seem to solve that was actually like that, hey, your art isn't on chain, because in the ordinal system, it looks like you actually do put some data within it, but it's not held on chain. So it actually solves two problems that I don't like. One, there's no chain bloat, because it's almost like it's like a self-hosted client or something that's reading this data rather than putting it right on chain. Or somehow you're reading it through there. So it kind of solves those two things. I'm not very super educated on it. I read the docs. I thought it was interesting. I didn't really like the NFT part of it, but I tried to read past it because it was talking about writing inscriptions on Bitcoin, and that part was interesting.
Yeah, and I think that there's a really interesting and important tool. And on your notes about this whole shell game has started with people trying to seek to put wealth into something, whether it's diamonds or art or whatever. Like, this is all part of a fundamental schizophrenia that society has developed around fiat. And like, that schizophrenia only develops through having a hyper paranoid society that can't save money anywhere, you know? Yeah. And so it becomes a schizophrenia of like, well, I have to put money here and here and here and here and here because everything could dissolve. And if everything dissolves, I have to do, and it just becomes this gigantic shell game. Where at the end, like, you're so frazzled and paranoid because it's like, okay, so like I made $2 million, but now I owe the government 60% of that $2 million. And I have to get more money here, and I have to make sure that I get that this, you know. And so by the end of this, you just get this massive, complicated structure that like essentially is the schizophrenia and paranoia of living in a world where you can't anchor to any form of truth anymore, because we live in a nihilistic hellscape where pretty much everyone tells you truth isn't a thing of this world. It doesn't matter. There's no good. There's no bad. There's just trying to live.
Well, back to what we were saying about politicians and central banking before, it's disincentivized for the elites. And so then, you know, that everyone else just copies. The incentive is to get ahead at all costs because, yeah, people's time is being stolen and they resort to extreme measures.
I just want to go back to a point that Eric made earlier before we wrap up the Wrecked segment and move on to Hopium. So you were talking about this grift, and Fractal Encrypt touched on the fact that this grift has many different levels, and this is true. And this is true, I believe, of pretty much all grifts. But the NFT grift specifically, having covered failed shitcoin projects now for like almost 3 years, the NFT grift is especially, I find, nefarious. And I understand that it's not somebody that's just sitting there going, you know, like, haha, I want to screw somebody. Although with NFTs, I beg to differ for some of these, a good portion of them. They market them a lot of these NFTs are marketed as investments specifically. I have no issue with this, like, because I'm a collector of crap. I've said this 1,000 times before. I collect Kid Robot dunnies, I collect Garbage Pail Kids. If I could afford Fractal Encrypt art, I would collect that. I have some pieces from Chief Monkey. Like, I love the swag. I love all of the fun stuff. I think it's amazing. But when you buy this stuff, you're buying it because you love it. You're buying it because you want to support the artist. You're not buying it because it's an investment. And if you are, then you're being misled, and you're possibly misleading yourself, because it's not an investment. Okay. Like, this is not something that it's not necessarily going to yield a return. That piece of art doesn't necessarily provide some type of a financial vehicle by way of producing income because of it just being there. Like, I understand that has happened due to scarcity and whatnot and the fame of the artist. But at the end of the day, a lot of times these people collect it because they start off collecting it because they loved it. They thought it was beautiful. They were willing to part whatever value they had because this thing meant something to them. And the problem with NFTs is all of this is meaningless. So they have no choice but to use this investment grift, because there is no other reason to hold a picture that you don't own. Like, it's just, it's psychotic. Like, it's, there's no other reason. Like, why would you do this? So they have to convince you that you're investing.
It is also going to continue, though, because I think I think we talked about this last week, like marketing agencies, it's a way for them to low cost produce some essentially worthless merchandise that they can sell for a whole bunch of different celebrities. You know, we saw last week, for example.
Continue, and it'll you know, not only that, it'll definitely grow. You know, I remember seeing it and thinking, oh, this stuff will die off, you know, and then, you know, Coca-Cola is doing it, and, you know, like, basically, like, a whole bunch of celebrities that I thought were cool started doing it, and then you're like, oh, this person's an idiot. And then it's like, you know, it's I think this stuff will grow, but the investment angle is actually a very interesting thing, because a lot of these NFT things, it ranges on different levels. You do have people that are like able to write their own smart contracts and issue their own tokens and stuff like that, all the way to the other, like, totally, like, non, you know, like a package type scenario where you're just kind of having like a program print them out for you. So you have every level of kind of person that's releasing these things. And I totally forgot what the fuck I was talking about.
on that point, then, all the time.
All right, that wraps up the Wrecked segment. We are going to dive into the Hopium.
The Hopium, brought to you by Represent. Represent makes some wonderful apparel. T-shirts, hoodies, jumpers, tracksuit. They even make skateboard decks.
they are owned by a Bitcoiner. It's important that Bitcoiners support Bitcoiners and their businesses, especially when they're making such great quality products. And if you head over there and use the code pleb-underground, you might find a little treat for you, a little discount on the excellent quality items that you can buy there. Once again, if you head over to representltd.com, you can find all of these very nice goods. So for this week's Hopium, I have three little links I'm going to share quickly in succession. The first, we have a new bit of technology using Lightning. A company has been developing a payment module that essentially enables existing vending machines to accept Lightning payments. Which sounds quite interesting to me. But the news of the week to me has certainly been Noster.
And
for me, it's more interesting what Noster can enable rather than Noster itself at this moment in time. I feel like, you know, right now we're all on Twitter. There's better, discovery. Yeah, okay, there's a bunch of shitcoiners you need to block and all this kind of stuff. But the conversation is happening elsewhere. But Noster as a protocol can be used to host a whole range of things, including a decentralized GitHub, which to me has a huge potential. And then lastly, a link from Coinbeast. Apparently in The Simpsons, they predicted the price of Bitcoin will be infinite. And we all know how everything that The Simpsons predicts comes true. So, guys, the Hopium.
Okay, that's huge. The Simpsons one, that's what got me. So look, if we get Family Guy and South Park as well, then we have the trifecta. Okay, and it's guaranteed. At that point, it doesn't even make a difference anymore what Bitcoin does, because those three shows will make it true. Eric, prophecy. Oh, Fractal, go ahead.
I just said it becomes a prophecy at that point. Once you've hit all three, you know, the trilogy.
No, absolutely. 100%.
No, but that's pretty cool about the Noster thing. I haven't ever used Noster yet. I've seen all the discussion about it. It certainly looks interesting, but seeing that you could run the GitHub from it certainly makes you think that's really interesting when you have things that are protocols. It's not just an app. You know, there's actually more things you can do because it's a base layer, so you can build on top of it and do these interesting things that we're seeing. And, you know, I've seen some really neat things with the lightning faucets that people are doing on Noster. And I'm just seeing it on Twitter, of course, because people are sharing it here, thank goodness. And really, you know, Elon kind of Streisand affected it into everybody, because I was like, I even tweeted, I was like, I really didn't care about Mastodon and Noster at all until, you know, you just made it a policy that we're not allowed to talk about it. All of a sudden, it's like interesting to me. So.
And it shows that decentralization can be done without a blockchain, which I think is going to be a good way to kind of ward people off using a whole bunch of shit coins, which obviously aren't really decentralized anyway, but being sold on blockchain is the only way to kind of decentralize.
Oh wow, that's a good point.
I have used Noster.
Yeah, I mean, like
oh, go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, like, this is the sort of pedagogical thinking around Bitcoin that I think is really important, because like, not Noster obviously isn't directly related to Bitcoin, but it is about having decentralized, robust protocols that are censorship resistant. And to me, yeah, and this is all the praxeology that like Bitcoin is around, is that like, I was writing about this recently, that like Bitcoin in a way, it's almost like this object that has a halo around it. And like as an object, it doesn't matter. It's sort of the light of the halo that's around it, of all the stuff about people understanding why cryptography is important, people understanding why a signing device is important, people understanding why holding your own coins is important. And to me, like the development that we get with Bitcoin is kind of being like the backbone or the preeminent piece to this whole puzzle is really important, because that's through that form of thinking, that's what's going to give us all these other things, like decentralized social media, like a decentralized GitHub, like a decentralized JSTOR, you know, and like eventually it gets to a place where the whole stack from the machine to the web browser to the software to the protocols that you're using are all going to be decentralized, robust, and meaningfully encrypted in a way that, like, we're not just going to get hosed anytime somebody doesn't like something that we say.
Are you guys familiar with IPFS at all?
Yep. That's what they use for the NFT storage, right?
Exactly. Yep. So yeah, when I was Chitcoining, that was one of the places where that we were storing the NFTs was on something called IPFS. It's basically like BitTorrent. And that was another part of the thing that I didn't like, where they say, oh, you know, your art is on chain forever. And a lot of things are stored on this IPFS. And the way that it actually works is exactly like BitTorrent. If you're not seeding the data, then it just ceases to be on the internet anymore. It's just gone forever. Like, somebody has to be invested enough to want to seed your stupid fucking cartoon, you know, into eternity. And I don't think many people are going to be incentivized to that. But I've kind of veered off to the side of my point, is that IPFS, part of it is actually pretty interesting to have, like, a decent centralized, like, instead of BitTorrent, where you're just kind of going and grabbing files, it's actually like an online entity where, like, people are just run, like, I ran my own instance of IPFS, and you could pin your own data there, and it didn't have to just be, you know, like, it could be anything that you wanted to pin, like any type of data. So it became like a server that you could then, you know, have and, like, and then access from anywhere in the world through this thing, and it worked on hashing, and it was a pretty interesting concept in some ways for that. So I definitely think that there's room for those type of technologies. Now, they totally screwed the whole thing up with that Filecoin thing that they did with that. So Filecoin's absolutely worthless, but, like, the IPFS part of it that sits behind it, that part of it is a semi-interesting thing.
I mean, to me, this is the hilarious nature of crypto and how, like, it's encrypted its own nature to itself, is that, like, the whole Trojan horse methodology of Bitcoin is, like, letting shitcoiners think that they can do the same thing. They go off and fuck it up. But, like, in that, they do all of this excellent development for Bitcoin that allow, you know, and, like, there's been so many developments across the board in terms of both cryptography and methodology that, like, now that we have all of these failed shitcoin projects that did that, we can appropriate different aspects of it, you know? So, yeah. So things like ZK Snarks, you know, there's all sorts of different developments that I think are great. And, like, Ordinals is another great example, is that we had 5 years of people fucking around with NFTs and doing all this other stuff. But because they were doing all of that garbage, we're able to pick out all the little gems from it and go, oh, that, like, this stuff could actually work pretty well for decentralization. Oh, like, this stuff's good for censorship resistant.
And even so, like, if none of it works is kind of an interesting thing too. Even if there's no gems to pick out, at least you've kind of battle tested a whole bunch of things that people thought was good enough to throw billions of dollars into, and now they've just horribly failed.
Like, so turns out that, like, big blocks are a terrible idea, and, like, we're really happy that they went and ran big blocks on Bcash so we could see what an absolute clusterfuck that was, you know. Yes. And to me, like, this is one of the reasons that, like, I'm not,
don't trust Verify.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, like, this is one of the reasons that, like, as much as, like, one, I think shitcoining is inevitable because it's sort of the original sin of Bitcoin. And two is that, like, I think they actually do, like, a bunch of really great work for us. And one of those is that, like, look at how much noise crypto's created over the last 2 years that's really allowed for Bitcoin to continue on its own development path and not get fucked with. And, like, that's really important because, like, if it was just Bitcoin out there by itself, you bet they'd be gunning for us super hard. But instead, we get frauds like SFB, who steals a bunch of money from all of these morons who don't understand what's going on. And that becomes the big story, as opposed to the fact that, you know, a country of 6 million people has adopted Bitcoin as their national currency.
It's an interesting thought. Bitcoin gets a shield.
FSB. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, whatever. Acronym boy.
Yeah, shitcoins are definitely a proof to show us things that should not be done. And I'm not talking about the technology itself. I'm talking about the addition of the useless fucking token to the technology. Like,
and that's
so
their
it's
proof
bad.
Of work is proving the work. Yeah. Like, shit token doesn't actually work. And so, like, we applaud them and go, thank you for showing us that was a terrible idea.
What I like is that it means that idiots who don't actually use their brain, who outsource all their thinking, don't yet buy Bitcoin, and I can keep buying it slightly cheaper. So thank you for being distracted by the complete nonsense that is shitcoinery. To me, yeah, the Simpsons thing is clearly some good hopium. But I'm really excited about what Nostr's gonna enable. But I wanna wrap up hopium just after, unless Fractal Encrypt has anything more to say, sir.
I got curious all of a sudden if any of you guys are running that Nostr thing. Like, what do you think? Like,
I am.
Have you used it? Well, what's the deal?
I am. I'll just talk quickly on it. So I'm running the Damus client, or Damus, however you want to pronounce it. It's on iOS. Sorry.
Shout out to William Kasserin who made it. It's phenomenal.
Oh, cool.
Absolutely. Shout out to William. So I installed that on iOS, and I also used the web version. I think it was Ninja. Ninja dot
Astral Ninja.
Yeah.
Astral.ninja.
Thank you. Astral.ninja. Awesome. Okay, we're gonna put those links in the show notes for the people who want to go mess around with Nostr. So look, the UX in Damus is great. It's a nice slick user experience. Keep in mind it is in test flight right now. So there's like a lot of features that aren't there yet, but the look and the feel, it's like you could swap between Twitter and that, because we have to give Twitter credit where credit is due, right? It is a desirable user experience. People do enjoy it. It is evidenced by its network growth and its network effect. So these are fantastic. What sucks is all the censorship and the bullshit. So these clients that people are building, they can suck those parts out and just leave the censorship-free communications and the fact that anybody could be running a message relay. I really think that a protocol like Nostr is going to help apps give Twitter a run for their money. So,
and
yeah.
And then how does it work in terms of, like, I know Mastodon was where people had servers and you were going into servers, and I didn't like the idea that, like, you know, like the admin of the server had certain controls, you know, that they might be able to see your stuff or things of that nature. So that was why I didn't use Mastodon. Is Nostr, like, do you connect to someone else's instance, or how is that part of it?
So,
like, what are you doing to get to other people?
So I don't know like the real nuanced detail of it. And we're actually working on getting somebody that's working on Nostr to come on the show to explain a lot of the nuance. But I do know this, the message relays, from what I read, if you set up a relay server, you have no ability to do anything. It's like a dumb server. It only receives and forwards the messages. That's it. So are not really,
it's like a message client. It's just sending and receiving.
Exactly. And the person running it, it does not give them any administrative privilege over the message data.
Okay. So it's like if you send it to them, like they're
binary. They relay everything or nothing, basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a dumb relay, which is pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, look, as this continues to exist, right, we're all going to be learning about it a whole lot more. And, you know, going back to, I don't know if it was Eric's point about this, but you see, like, Bitcoin created that. Yeah, it was Eric that said this, the Bitcoin halo effect. That's exactly what this is. You know, it shines the light, unlike my camera that just turns off.
Let there be light.
All right. We are going to wrap up the hopium. Walton, take it away, my friend. Wrap it up.
That was the hopium, brought to you by Represent. That's representltd.com. So we have a final segment here, a little chat with our guests. I had a plan for the show to bring these two guests together. I don't know if they've been paired before, but to talk a little bit about psychedelics. A few years ago, when I was a younger man, I was a little bit of an amateur psychonaut. But it's been a few years. But I do think there is a correlation between people who are willing to kind of think outside the box, people who ask more questions, and people who do psychedelics, and people who are into Bitcoin. And one other kind of weird thought I've had is that, to me, Bitcoin kind of is a psychedelic. But it enables you to kind of, to me, to see reality and not be able to kind of see the lies over the top. And sometimes it can be slightly frustrating, right? Like you can't, you've gone outside of Plato's cave, right? You now know the truth. You can't like listen to the lies. It can be kind of painful to hear, interact. You talked about Eric earlier, like interacting with normies can be painful because they have these shrouds and it's hard to communicate. And I certainly feel that, yeah, guys, Bitcoin and psychedelics, I don't, up to you who goes first, but I want to hear more.
I definitely think Bitcoin is psychedelic. You know, said the very words itself just means mind manifesting, and if Bitcoin is nothing else, it's certainly mind manifesting, and it's kind of one of those never-ending rabbit holes. You know, you can continue to go down it, and no matter which avenue you go, that just there's just more ways to go, and it kind of keeps branching off. And I feel like psychedelics tend to do that as well, where there's just always more to find out and almost more questions than there will ever be answers. And I think that's a fun thing because it's like a mystery that will never fully unravel because it can't, you know, like there is no end to that rabbit hole.
Well, and the other one I'd point out is specifically with Bitcoin, like there's a very, very deep and very, very important relationship between Bitcoin and psychedelics. Like Ross Ulbricht specifically designed the Silk Road so that he could sell magic mushrooms online. So like you figure that some of the most OG people involved with Bitcoin probably had something to do with those early darknet markets. And furthermore, like these people probably weren't solely motivated just by an economic praxis, but like they probably found that it was really important to try to get these tools into the hands of the right people. Which so like now we have this dynamic relationship interacting between people who do psychedelics and the importance of encryption and how it protects them and creating this totally new market that facilitates people voluntarily doing transactions with one another with the assurance that now the state isn't going to come in and break their hands just because they're curious about experimenting with their own mind. You know, I'm like, that's really, really important. Yeah, exactly.
You know, he grew the mushrooms himself so he could have, you know, so he can have that product. So I love to circle back to that deep relationship that the two have as it goes back to that very beginning. And I think it goes back even farther. You know, encryption and psychedelics have been tied together since they basically began free to the people, you know, in the sense of the 1970s, we saw a whole renaissance of cryptography becoming public. Prior to that, it was mostly a military technology, and they were actually really pissed off that people like Diffie and Hellman were starting to release this technology into the wild, and they actually fought them over it. And I think that's part of the reason why there's that fight for self-sovereignty and privacy that's kind of linked into this. And all this kind of happened in the San Francisco Bay Area, which was kind of a psychedelic hotspot. So you have this mixture of technology, psychedelics, and personal computing that kind of all brewed together in this weird mix of cultural and also physical geospatial location and temporal as well. So you have this time and space location that's kind of this nexus of like the 60s to 70s in the Bay Area, where all this like both military technology was happening as well as the psychedelic revolution. So these things are deeply intertwined at a level where even when psychedelics weren't illegal, they were being used by the computer scientists of that day. So, and a lot of them felt like, you know, like they were wresting control from the corporations, because computing at first was very much a tool of the corporation, a tool of the large, powerful industry and stuff like that. To have a mainframe computer, to have one of these computers, you had to have, you know, mega money, you know, $500,000 in the 60s or something like that. So the ability to think about, to even have the possibility in your brain that you could bring one of these things into your house and maybe use it for your own personal uses rather than the government's desires was a revolutionary thing. And these people saw the power that personal computing could bring to self-sovereign individuals. So I think Bitcoin is a direct extension of all these things that have been brewing for a while. And I just love to see the mushroom Bitcoin connection
there. I think sovereignty is a key aspect of it, because I think if you've ever used psychedelics, you very much believe that you have sovereignty of your total self. And Bitcoin is the belief that you have sovereignty of your time. And so as you reference, it's about sovereignty of space and time. The space that you inhabit primarily being, and I say primarily as a slip of the tongue actually, but I mean it actually quite deliberately, that the space that you occupy primarily is your own body. And so yeah, you should have sovereignty over that. completely.
Yeah, I don't know if I buy into the fact that just using the psychedelics is enough, because you run into a bunch of people that also use psychedelics that aren't good, like, models as far as people or sovereign individuals. So, like the psychedelic itself, while it's a tool, it can be used or misused, just like Bitcoin can. You know, you can accidentally do some things in Bitcoin, although Bitcoin accidents are permanent and on-chain forever, so, you know, your ancestors can laugh at you and stuff like that. But, you know, I think it's all relevant there. So I think, like, you have some level of skill with what you're using. Oh, did they cut out? Yeah, I was just saying that you want to have the tool, but you also want to have some level of skill or adeptness with using it, or some kind of guide that, you know, that you're doing this in a manner that's going to benefit you in some way, because any tool can be used in a way that can hurt or benefit you. So
I like to say that with full sovereignty comes full responsibility, and that's exactly
yes. what I'm speaking to. You can end up on the wrecked section of this show.
Yeah, a lot in the rec section. Well, next week we'll talk more about Phil's camera. Does he need a new one?
Yeah, we've crossed the hour and a half mark. It's too hot.
For wrong thing. You know, yeah. You could still end up in a area.
Guys, I think we should wrap that. It's been a real pleasure. Merry Christmas to you all. Phil has some final words.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so first of all, I'm gonna steal a Walton line and just say fuck shitcoins, but I need Walton to say it too. But before we wrap up this segment, I, you know, listening to you guys talk about, you know, Bitcoin and psychedelics and of course not having done those types of drugs in several years, I'm thinking back to those experiences, and of course Bitcoin didn't exist back then. You know, all we had was the tinfoil hats and our conspiracies, because I'm a Gen Xer. And you know what's really interesting to me is the connection in terms of psychedelics, the desire for higher consciousness, and also at the same time, fiat money keeping us in base consciousness. And I'm not talking about the based term that people use where based. No, this is bad. This is bad base. Okay. This is shit base.
Yeah, you mean animalian.
This is the lead.
You mean good base,
right?
Phil, right? You mean
this is like alchemical lead, so to speak, right? Like this is what that is. And if you think about it, the quality of our money has kept our consciousness in this in this lead. Okay. And it doesn't mean that beautiful things can't spring from it or anything like that, but they take so much more work because they're fighting against so much more current. And I feel that with Bitcoin, Bitcoin allows more of that consciousness work to take, to actually take hold in society, because people no longer need to busy themselves with as much of this base behavior to keep the wheel turning. So that's absolutely just my thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean that's part of the kind of schizophrenia and paranoia that fiat creates that I was talking about. And in the same way that like psychedelics are really important, because I think it gives you such a radical encounter with the truth that like after that's over, like you can come back into this space and continue to like play fiat games and be an asshole. But like at the back of your mind, like you've seen the truth. And you know what's actually there. And so like now there's at least a choice about what you can do. And in the same way, like once you actually get Bitcoin, like you're welcome to go back to fiat world and do that. But like there will be the problem of you can see that there's a problem with fiat money and how it was created. And there's no relationship that tethers it to reality. And this creates all these other problems, you know? And so to me, the main thing that both Bitcoin and psychedelics do is it allows for us to see the truth, so then we can make a choice. And like, we're not saying that the truth is easy or that it's fun or even that it feels good, but it is what it is. And you can have a choice to pursue that or this other form of life that you've been given.
Yeah, I think the two are about exercising your right over your time, with fiat very much being where another group of people is arguing that they own part of your time.
Yeah, when Phil was saying that, it kind of brought to my mind almost like an evil alchemy where that like they've figured a way to turn lead into gold by giving us this paper fiat money. So fiat is like this evil alchemy where they've figured this trick that they can do with black magic and actually pulled the wool over the whole world's eyes by giving us this paper dollars and telling us it's gold. So they finally found this way to do their right? evil alchemy. So I don't know if that just was a thought that popped into my head while you were talking.
Yeah.
Damn it, we're vibing and the camera's gone. All right.
All right, guys. Message to the universe. Happy holidays, 20. You can find Pleb Underground on a whole range of platforms, YouTube, but also audio only platforms such as Anchor, Spotify, and
Apple. Apple. And then if you want to stream us sats, check us out on fountain.fm.
Oh, Breeze!
With Breeze. All right, and wait, before we go, how do we find our guests? Eric, you go first. How do people find you?
I have a blog called cryptosovereignty.org. I'll be taking most of my articles in there and publishing that in a book with Bitcoin Magazine shortly. And outside of that, you can find me on Twitter. It's just my name, E-R-I-K-C-A-S-O-N, on Twitter. Yeah, and I'm always open to dialogue, so feel free to shoot me a DM or comment on any of the crazy stuff I say.
Very cool, very cool. Fractal, where do we find you, my dude?
Eric with a K when you look him up. I remember the first time I did, I got confused when I heard it on the whatever, and I was like, oh,
because otherwise it'd be two C's stuff back to back. And it
I found a bunch of bots.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, his parents would have never done that to him. So, yeah. So, anyways, you can find me at Fractal Encrypt on Twitter.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you so much. Guys, don't forget to like and subscribe. Happy holidays. This episode, you guys are going to watch this on Monday, but this is actually being recorded on Friday, and we will be back next week with episode 21.
With a very secret guest. Who's it going to be? I don't know. Well, actually, I might do, but shh, you'll find out soon. So yeah, guys, Merry Christmas. And what do we say around here, Phil?
Fuck shit coins.
Fuck shit coins.
Peace. All right. Happy holidays, guys. Merry Christmas. And hope to see you soon. Be well.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's getting ready for the new year. Happy New Year. Yeah.